This week on the BOAG World Show, we have talks on best practice in web development and the impact of technology on design. This week's show is sponsored by Teacup AdWords and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG. Joining me on this week's show, as always, is Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm exhausted.
Oh, yeah, it's a bit warm, isn't it? But mustn't complain, because we like it when it's warm.
Oh, no, I'm not complaining in any way. I'm exhausted because of the amount of work.
You were complaining about that last week, and you're just not used to it, are you, Paul?
I know. I had to speak at a conference on Friday, and then we were away for the weekend, although really you're not going to give me much sympathy when I say what we did. And then we're off to, well, you and me are both off to another conference. Well, you're not going tomorrow, are you? You're going the day after.
Yes.
Yeah, so we're going to another conference over the rest of the week. Oh, dear me, I need a lie down.
Conferences are just a bit of a doddle, though, really, aren't they?
Well, except I've got to do work while I'm at the conference.
Yeah, I tend to always do work. It's partly an excuse because I don't want to go and watch any of the talks. I'm only there really to kind of meet up with old friends and sort of maybe nudge them in the ribs for a bit more work and that kind of thing.
Right. So you're not, you know, you don't want to learn anything.
That's not completely true. I tend to sit and enjoy all the plenary talks, but the workshops are like
Interaction is not really our thing, is it?
No, they don't want me there anyway.
It's quite good, because especially the conference we're going to is a higher education conference, and you do feel a bit like an awkward outsider.
Yeah. From the dark side.
And you don't want to kind of overly push it by interfering too much in workshops and stuff where they want to talk about their problems and their issues. But I do enjoy the plenaries. I was at a higher education conference on Friday, and there was a person giving a talk before me that was absolutely brilliant. She was a woman that works with IT directors, basically, and teaches them emotional intelligence, which is, I think, quite
good. We've all met IT directors, haven't we?
Yeah, but actually, she's teaching them to play the politics game, which is it is quite interesting actually, and how to do so in a way that actually brings colleagues along and stuff. Which in our industry is so important. If you want to bring about change, digital change, you need to win people over, which is my thing as well, isn't it?
So it is most definitely yes.
It was good. So why are you not coming until Wednesday? What, you just slacking off for a day?
I just thought I'd have tomorrow off. No,
I mean, you don't want to have to listen to Brian, who kicks off this conference.
It will be a bit weird not being there for the first. A lot of them have arrived today, if you're looking at it on Slack. But no, my son is officially cleverer than me as from tomorrow. I mean, he is anyway, has been for a long time, but he graduates tomorrow. We're going to the graduation ceremony. He's got a 2-1 in physics from the University of Surrey.
But he was already officially more intelligent than you because he got A-levels and you dropped out.
That's true. Yeah, but even more so. More so.
What was his degree in the game? Remind
physics,
me?
A proper degree.
Yeah, that is a proper degree. That's what my son wants to do.
Well, I think he'll enjoy it. But if you ever want some advice on the modules to take, James made some potentially the wrong choices. He sort of went, that sounds interesting, and took a quantum mechanics one or something like that, and he said it was just so hard, it was just mad, and he could have done a much simpler module and kind of breezed it a bit more, and maybe even got a first, but he's quite happy.
It's difficult that, because my son, my boy is obsessed with quantum mechanics and that kind of thing, so he would be very tempted by that, but sometimes pick the path of least resistance.
I mean, it's a bit of both, obviously, but he just said it's just so hard, and it was a new module, so it had never been questions had never been set or marked.
A mistake. It was like I was the first year of GCSEs, which on some of my GCSEs was devastating and led to really low results, and then in other areas like French. I walked away with a D, and I should have walked away with a nothing.
I got a D in French. That's the only O level, because I did O levels because I'm older than you. It was the only one I failed. I got A's and B's and everything. School was easy in those days. Yeah. And then I did A levels and thought, oh, you've got to do some work now. And I thought, I don't want to do that. And went off and played in a rock and roll band.
Well, rock and roll makes it sound cooler than it was.
Yeah, it wasn't really, was it? Well, it was quite cool, but it wasn't as cool as a rock and roll band.
No. So what's he going to do? What's his plans?
It's very likely he did a year out, like a sandwich year in his... Because he did 2 years university, 1 year in industry, and then another year again. He worked for a company called Tesla, which is not the same as the Tesla that does the electric cars.
Okay.
It's a Tesla that builds giant magnets for things like the Hadron Collider and stuff like that. And he's hoping, it's looking quite likely that he'll end up going back there.
Nice. I tell you, dear listener, if you ever get a chance to intern somewhere or do a year's placement, take it. Because it always is that first step of like networking and who you know, and that's where you get work from, isn't it, really?
I also think that it helps if you do a degree in something that it has a specific, if you do this, you can do that job. I'm not saying we should, completely throw out, history of art degrees. Of course not. And I'm not taking the mick there. I mean that.
No.
But if you're weighing up the stuff at the beginning and you're great at something like physics, then do it.
Yeah.
It will lead into more opportunities than, I don't know, I can't think of an example.
History of art.
Well, but I was thinking a science-y equivalent, but there isn't really one, is there? But, it's a really useful thing to have under your belt, whereas something that's more kind of just because you like it might not lead on to a job. I sound like all teacher and a fatherly. I am there, aren't I?
It's up to people, isn't it? It's what they want to do with their lives. But you've got to say it does make things much easier if your course has got a vocation at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, physics hasn't particularly. Obviously, you could become a scientist of some researcher or something like that. But it's useful for all sorts of, you could go into banking or accountancy or coding. He's done loads of coding over the last 3 or 4 years.
I mean, look at Chris Henderson, a developer at Headscape. He did physics, didn't he?
Maths, he did.
Oh, was it maths?
Yeah,
oh.
but physics is tons of maths anyway. So,
and then Chris, obviously Chris Scott, who's got a PhD in physics.
Yep, sat just outside the door there, looking all scholarly.
Is he? He always looks scholarly.
Just at the back of his head. I was just making that bit up.
Okay, right. Well, then that's enough. People, did people learn anything from that? We learned that you need to play politics. We learned that you want to do a year's placement if you're thinking about studying. So actually we provided real value in our introduction.
Hard to believe, but maybe we did.
Shocking but true. Right, let's talk about our first sponsor and then we'll actually get to a talk. Cool. Which is quite an interesting one, talking about starting in one vocation and ending up in another. But we'll come to that in a minute. So, Full Story. I want to talk about Full Story that I've been going on about for the last few weeks. Basically, it's the analytics package that actually provides real insights rather than Google Analytics. I really don't like Google Analytics. Can you tell? Mm-hmm. I really don't like it. The only thing that Google Analytics has got going for it is it's got an API that other pieces of software can plug in and extract useful information. That's it, in my opinion. But anyway, so we've talked about Full Story before. We've talked about how, it allows you to do very specific searches to find out information on how many people clicked a certain button or went up to a certain page and all of this kind of stuff. How it also allows you to drill down and look at user sessions and actually play back a user session and see what exactly is going wrong, which is obviously all of that is great for diagnosing problems. Where's something going wrong with the website? Why is it going wrong? What's happening there? But what if you want to know about a specific page rather than a person. Now, this is something that for me is quite an important aspect, because I'll write a blog post and I want to know, you know, how long people have spent on a particular part of the article, or whether they've then spotted the call to action and all of those kinds of things. So I tend to approach a lot of the stuff I do with Full Story from that perspective. For that, you can get page insights. And it basically will give you exactly that. It will let you see what elements of the page users are clicking on, looking at, all of those kinds of things, which is really, really useful as well. So, and what's really nice is if users do weird stuff, which they do, for example, my most recent blog post, for some reason, the fourth most clicked thing on the post was the introduction to it, right? Which doesn't have a link in it. Very peculiar. So you can then dig in and say, well, tell me more about this element. You know, what's going on with this element? Let me watch some user sessions of people interacting with this element and all that kind of stuff. Very, very cool indeed. So you can sign up today and see
why were they clicking?
To be honest, I don't know.
A good story then, was it?
It did peter out at the end, I must admit. To be honest, I was looking at it just before this podcast, and so I was kind of halfway through looking at it, and I didn't manage to fully delve into it.
You can tell everyone next week, Paul.
I think the answer is people are stupid. That's what I'm going with.
Okay.
That's my preliminary results. And I am now going to carry out extensive research to discover whether my readers are really stupid. So if you're listening to this show and you do read my blog posts, if you could send me an email telling me what 2 + 2 is, that would be great. So, yeah. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah. So if you want to give it a go, basically, you can get a free month of the pro account. Absolutely free by going to fullstory.com/BOAG. You don't need to enter a credit card or anything, so it's very straightforward. If at the end of that month you want to carry on with Pro, you can do so and you can pay money, or you can carry on for free and get 1,000 sessions per month recorded for free, which obviously is pretty damn good too. So there we go. Right, let's talk about our first talk today. It's got I'm beginning to be a bit suspicious of this, right? And the reason is talk by a guy called Ian Frost, right? No big deal there. He's a front-end developer, web developer in Pittsburgh, and he's worked on all kinds of different projects, really. Done a lot of work with pattern libraries, building websites, worked for companies like about.com and ExxonMobil. Mobile. So he does loads of cool stuff. Now, why I'm somewhat suspicious of him is his surname. Because he used to be a weatherman, or a meteorologist, sorry.
I see and where this is going now.
And he's called Frost.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, a dentist being called Mr. Tooth. You know, it's a made-up name, isn't it?
I don't think it is. There are lots of people who had names like that. I was listening to something on the radio the other day. The kind of the head of the judiciary used to be called Mr. Judge.
Oh, that is so cool.
And there was a few. That was the one that stuck with me, but there was a few.
Do you think that your surname lends you or encourages you towards a certain career?
I think it possibly does, based on what I wish I could remember what it might have been on the telly, might have been on the radio, I don't know, but I was listening to this thing and it was very amusing.
My worry about that, if that is true, I had a physics teacher called Mr. Killer.
Really? What, K-I-L-L-E-R?
Yeah, yeah. And I still see him quite a lot because he goes to my church.
No, so, I don't believe you. You made that up.
Absolutely true. You can Google him. Wow. Jeff Killer.
Sorry.
He's a really nice chap. He's like the most unkillery killer ever. So, yeah. In fact, he's a bit of a hero at us. You know how you always get those teachers that are heroes? And he has been, he's been one of those kind of guys that everybody absolutely loves. He taught me when I was at school, and he's still teaching there now.
So well, I never. I found a different Jeff Killer. There's two of them.
There we go. That's even worse, isn't it?
Unbelievable. Well, yeah. I have learnt something today. Killer can now can be a surname.
There you go. So anyway, so Ian, setting aside his surname, which used to work, as I say, in meteorology, and he uses that as a jumping off point in his talk to talk about how to transition from one career into web development and some of the things that he learned along the way of doing that. So over to Mr. Frost.
You're taught at a young age that if you do well in high school and go to college, you will get a job in what you studied and do that until you retire. I agree with the first part that if you do well in high school, you might get a chance to go to college. The second part, though, I don't completely agree with, because even if you get a job in your field, you may not stay in it forever. Why not? To me, it has to do with the balance between work and life. As a meteorologist, I loved forecasting the weather. The life part is where I struggled, as I was long distant from my longtime girlfriend still, worked overnights and weekends, and the opportunities within my field were hard to achieve in a short amount of time. So, I decided to get married, move to Pittsburgh, and with help from my brother, become a web developer. The field of web design and development is full of people who didn't start out in the web. My story is one of many. My name is Ian Frost, and I am a front-end developer. I am here to compare and contrast the non-web and web fields and explain the methods of working in a way that is efficient for me and the teams I collaborate with. The web is a unique medium to work in. It is full of intimidating folks who happen to be some of the nicest and most helpful people, but yet you're still intimidated because they are incredibly intelligent. It is a field where there are tons of ways to do the same thing, and patience is a must as you write and sift through lines of code. But most of all, the web is a field that is a melting pot of men and women who may have started out in entirely different fields. Weather and web design are similar in a lot of ways. Both are sciences that tend to get simplified by the general public. You're a weatherman. It's the only job where you can be wrong 50% of the time and keep it. You're a web designer. I have this great idea for an app. I need it done in a week. These are two fields that the general public get excited about, but don't know a lot about. Another similarity is that the atmosphere is ever-changing in meteorology, just like the innovations and improvements of web design and development are ever-changing. There's always something new and exciting with both, whether it's a big snowstorm hitting the East Coast in weather, or CSS grid layout getting browser support in web design. People in weather have strong opinions on climate change, just like people in web can have strong opinions on whether or not to use spaces or tabs for indentation in their code. I won't discuss either, as I feel like I'd spawn an angry mob of listeners with pitchforks and torches whichever way I leaned on these subjects. One of the bigger similarities I come back to between meteorology and web development is that of empathy. A meteorologist needs to know its audience to speak in a voice and tone that makes sense to the majority of the demographic, just like a web designer needs to know its stakeholders and users to create a design, content, and functionality that positively impacts both. Finally, both fields require teamwork and collaboration to achieve the best result. My former coworkers and I used to create our seasonal forecast together as a unit, while I now work with other web developers, designers, project managers, stakeholders, and users as a team to create successful projects. Both of these require discussion so that everyone is on the same page with what is going on in the weather and in the web world. While there are many similarities between other fields and the web world, there are differences as well. Products built 2 years ago can be ancient to the web community, while they can be new and innovative in the weather community. Working in the web consists of more long-term deadlines, while the weather world contains more of a daily routine with hourly deadlines. Finally, web design and development opportunities are increasing, while parts of the weather enterprise are being downsized. All in all, the web world is different because it is young compared to most other fields. You have folks who are well known within the web community who started out in something totally different, who jumped on an opportunity when they saw the impact the web had on the world. The web's widespread influence on other fields, its youthfulness, and the amount of resources online are also reasons why people in other fields can learn relatively quickly how to design or develop. These different backgrounds that people have help to create a variety of perspectives on a project. The web is progressive as it always looks to the future for the next idea or innovation. Being one of the new kids on the block, it's hard to keep up sometimes with how quickly things move. That's why I continue to learn by reading books and blogs, as well as use the successes and failures of projects to tweak my methods to approaching a new opportunity. Keep learning or get left behind. One of the changes that has proved most successful in how the web works over the past decade is that of a more collaborative and involved web team. Instead of designers drawing up comps in a dark corner and passing them over a cubicle wall to a developer to put in a code, and then the developer throwing it back over the cubicle wall to the designer because they technically cannot work in the design, designers and developers are becoming more of a team. Who would have thought that design and development could be more of a group effort, talking together through the design and transcribing it into pixels? Tweaks can be made within the code instead of going back and forth between CSS and Sketch. Be transparent with your work. Include the marketing team, stakeholders, and even the CEO in your meetings about the project. Obviously, there are times where internal or separate meetings need to take place, but the clearer everyone's top priorities are, the more successful a project can be. Kickoff meetings are a great way to include everyone so that those priorities and goals can be decided on and worked toward. Work in a more modular way. What does this mean? Organize your project in a way where you can break your website down into a more component-based structure, breaking down the HTML, CSS, and JavaScript into more component-based files rather than page-based. Methods like atomic design allow a user to not only compartmentalize components into separate files, but also allow for reusability across your website or application. Set guidelines and principles. While writing HTML, CSS, and even JavaScript are relatively straightforward as coding languages, it is easy to let your code unravel into a mess. Old code, nesting of CSS, and lack of structure really clump together and start to look like the dusty stick emoji in Slack. How do we fix this? 1. Decide upon naming conventions. Agree upon a CSS syntax like SMAX or BEM. We usually use BEM and add a C dash in front of components class names and an L dash in front of layout class names to know what bits of HTML are controlling the component itself or the layout. 2. Use parent selectors in your CSS to prevent crazy nesting. If you are using CSS extensions like SAS, use parent selectors within your component. This will decrease the amount of nesting you do in your CSS and keep your code organized within that one component rather than going on a scavenger hunt. If your code is more than 3 levels nested, you may want to rethink your process. 3. Space out your code. Instead of jumbling 3 different elements onto one line, space them out accordingly. Any element with more than one element inside, add spacing within. Spacing will improve readability of the code and make it easier to clean up or edit in the future. 4. Comment your code. If you ever had a computer science teacher, they always mentioned commenting and you ignored it. Now's your chance to totally redeem yourself and comment your code. Comments are important, especially since websites, pattern libraries, and design systems are usually not a set-it-and-forget-it thing. They are usually iterated upon and massaged until golden brown, so you better know what your code is doing or where it is ending. Otherwise, your recipe is really hard to follow, and you end up burning your toast and your head on the way to updating code you wrote months or years before. Setting these guidelines and principles will allow you or another developer to easily sit down with your code months or years down the road and understand it. Use your experience from your other field or fields to add a different perspective. Just because you may not have years and years of web design and development knowledge under your belt, you can use your prior experiences to add a different flavor of personality to your project. This may help with the design and development of the product or the user experience itself. Finally, be sure to challenge yourself and step out of your comfort zone. The more you're thrown into the fire of unknown territory within the web, the more you work hard to learn it and overcome the obstacles that come along the way. It's through these experiences where you learn the most about yourself and about the field. It's hard to survive in a field that is always changing if you stay within your comfortable bubble. Risk can lead to reward. Transitioning from any other field to web design is not an easy task, despite the folks in Stack Overflow using phrases like, just do this, or it's easy, simply do this. If you can take your education from the other aspects of your life and direct it towards the web, learn as much as possible from the smart and respectful web community, and organize your work in a way that can be followed by other members of your team, you will succeed in web design. Be grateful you have the ability to change the world through the web. Continue to challenge yourself. Respect your fellow colleagues and share the new knowledge you have gained. Thank you.
Really good talk. Enjoyed that. Lots of great tips about coding, which I always enjoy. I imagine you got particularly excited about that aspect of it.
Not particularly. Quite excited.
It was a technical talk that the likes of us could understand, which I always
totally
like.
Yeah, I mean, I found it was a talk mainly about going from one thing to another, which made me think, I wonder when we're going to stop hearing I ended up in the web from, you know, because I was a musician. I guess you're one of the few people who did kind of go straight into IBM, but you're doing sort of CD-ROM stuff.
Only for about a year.
Yeah.
Less than that, really.
But, you know, there are a lot of people like me and like Ian who just ended up taking a full U-turn or left turn, right turn, whichever analogy you like best, into working the web. And that's going to stop, or it's going to stop being such a common thing. Mm. And I wonder when that's going to be. Things are nothing like as kind of wild westy as they used to be. But I think we're, you know, from talking to clients or looking at clients' view of the work we do, they still see us as a bit kind of like, you know, they're the web designers, they're the crazy people, as opposed to being mainstream, even though we're not really. It's a bit rock and roll still, to use those words again.
Do you really
viewed that way, even though it isn't?
Well, is it viewed that way, or is it just viewed as the sad nerd sitting in the corner?
Maybe a bit of both, but it's not. But my point is, it's not mainstream yet.
Yeah,
but
I know what you mean.
It's getting more so. It is for us. I think we're, you know, as an industry, we are far more grown up, and, you know, from a sort of processes and the way we work and all those kind of things, much more grown up than they were 10, 15 years ago. But I still think, yeah, maybe sort of the view from the outside is one of still being a bit kind of Wild West like.
He made some really good comments, mine, didn't he? Mm-hmm. I agree with you've written down. I'm going to just steal one of your points now. That keep learning or get left behind, I thought, was a really good line.
Absolutely. And, you know, because I've always thought that I don't really learn anything, but I've been doing this podcast for 10, 12 years or whatever it is. It's 12 years now, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I've learnt tons of things from doing this podcast. So, yeah, that's the way I've kept up. You have to. Otherwise, yeah, you'll just end up doing the same thing all the time and people will stop hiring you.
I liked as well, risk leads to reward. That's actually a common theme out of this show, because both Ian and I've forgotten the person's name, Martin, who's up next, kind of talks about that pushing the boundaries all the time and moving forward. So that was a very good one. And yeah, he just had some really good stuff. This whole thing about empathy and communicating clearly and how important that was really good. Talked a lot about collaboration as well, which is a huge issue. And it made me, especially between designer and developer, and whenever I hear collaboration between designer and developer, I always think about Ed and Dan sitting side by side with, well, back to back with one another, actually.
It's like a marriage, those two.
They really are, aren't they? And Dan is our front-end coder, developer, and Ed is our designer, UI designer. And just the two of them, they bicker constantly, don't they? But they improve each other the whole time in doing so. It's very cool. They work really well together.
Very much so, yes. So the only other thing that I've – looking at my notes, because I thought this is quite an intelligent point for me, maybe. The point you made about people from different backgrounds bringing different perspectives. Of course, that's really true. And I just sort of wondered, and I may be wrong in this, that maybe that's why there's been so much innovation and it's been so quick, is the fact that we are getting so many people from so many different backgrounds and walks of life, and that maybe that all, when that changes and you go to university and you do a web degree and then you end up, you know, as a junior in an agency or whatever, that's going to, you know, so you're going to get the same people with the same viewpoint working within the web more in the future. Whether innovation will slow because of that. That might be just how things work. I don't know. But
it's an interesting issue, because we've certainly, a part of being a young industry is it forces you to look elsewhere and draw on other disciplines. Mm. You know, the most obvious is print design, maybe, but you could look at everything from, you know, architectural design. I think we've pulled quite heavily from publishing field, psychology, marketing, and that's just on the design side, let alone the coding side, which is drawn on game design. It's drawn on the software development, you know, all of these kinds of areas.
Yep.
So yeah, it's interesting. Will that go away?
Or just reduce.
Yeah, yeah. It will never go away, will it? But, yeah, I know what you mean. It's an interesting one. I like that. Mm. So, yeah, really great stuff. To be honest, I quite enjoyed just the list of code tips he shared. And it was interesting. He was talking about pattern libraries, wasn't he, and atomic design, which I've just literally just reposted an article on that, and how important it is to have pattern libraries, especially on larger sites. But it's quite difficult getting management to sign off on that sometimes. But that's what I kind of cover in the article. I think we're done with Ian. I think it was 10 out of 10, Ian. Well done.
Bye.
You get good marks.
Yes.
If this was American Idol, which Marcus was keen that it should be.
What?
Well, you wanted to. You wanted to judge everybody, didn't you?
Oh, but not. No, I didn't. You said that I wanted to. You made it a thing.
When I say something, it becomes truth.
It becomes a thing, yes.
I am the Donald Trump of
it was either last week or the week before, I did finish the show feeling a little bit too judgmental. Mm. I think it might have been last week, and I apologise to last week's speakers if I was a little bit too judgmental in my responses. I can't even remember who they were or what I said, but I can remember thinking, well, maybe I was being a bit too judgy there.
Ooh, and I mustn't be. Let me have a look. That was Brent was talking about being an entrepreneur, and Catalina, who was talking about productivity. I don't remember you being judgmental on either of those. Try harder, Marcus. They were really good talks. There was nothing really to be judgmental.
Fantastic. Best speeches I've ever heard.
Talks,
apart from these two and the ones in the future and the ones before.
Yeah, they're all good in their own special way.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I'm making myself feel physically sick now. Right, let's talk about teacup ad words before Marcus gets any more obnoxious. So I got a tour of it this week. Because I know obviously Teacup Analytics very well and I use it all the time, but I hadn't seen Teacup AdWords until this last week. And it's really good. It's so simple. It's just such a pleasure. I'm going to be using it myself. I'm talking about doing a course on, I've done a workshop on persuasive design. I'm talking about turning it into a course that I'm going to sell. And I was wanting to experiment with Google AdWords. But it's like every time I've ever used Google AdWords, it's just been a train wreck. And I've never got very good money out of it. And everybody else goes, oh, you know, Google AdWords, you've got to do Google AdWords. And I'm like, it doesn't make any money.
What do you use Google AdWords for? What would you use it for?
Well, Google AdWords. So if I was selling a course, I would on persuasive design, I would identify a set of keywords that people are searching for on, you know, persuasive design, calls to action or whatever else. And I would then put an ad in.
Yeah, I suppose.
And drive people through. But a lot of people, you'd be surprised, a number of the people I mentor that run digital agencies get work that way. You know, they target words like usability testing or, you know, or whatever else, and they win work that way. But I've never managed to get it to work. And I can tell from your cynicism, neither have you.
No. Well, money wasted.
Exactly. Well, that's what I kind of felt. Mm. But now I'm beginning to understand, after spending some time talking to Dean behind Teacup, that actually a lot of the time it's just because we didn't know what we were doing, if I'm honest. I mean, it's not our strength, is it? I mean, you know, Headscape is not a digital marketing agency. It's not what you do.
It's not. I also think it's to do with the kind of work you're after.
Yes, it is. It's
you
true.
Know, we are looking for a small number of large projects a year. And yes. I don't think I'm going to find them via Google AdWords.
No, I don't think you are either. That's certainly not what this Teacup AdWords is aimed at either. But what I guess I'm saying I learned through this is that getting to get value and to get AdWords to work for you, you have to do it right. Yeah. And I hadn't realized quite what was involved behind the scenes until I sat down and talked with Dean. It's a bit like, I don't know, anything, isn't it? It's a bit like SEO or whatever else, you know. And you know, you think you are a little, what is it they say? A little knowledge is dangerous, isn't it? Mm. You think you can do it and therefore it doesn't work. Therefore you decide it's stupid. No, you know, it's actually, there's a lot more to it. But Teacup AdWords make it really simple. Basically, you just start answering questions. And you answer as many questions as you can be bothered to answer. The more questions you answer, the more it learns about your business, and the more keywords it can find, and the more ads it then generates. And for each ad campaign it generates, it also creates its own custom landing pages, which is a really big factor that I mentioned last week. And so they're all the time are improving the algorithm. They're improving what's going on behind the scenes, and they seem to be making it simpler and simpler. Every iteration that I see of it is being improved and tweaked. And I'm working with them as well to improve the user interface and the flow and the journey. And so where they're at the moment is they're looking to get on some beta users that want to try it out and get early access to it and work with them really to improve the product. So if that's you, if you fancy having a go at it, if you want to be providing Google AdWords for your clients, for example, this is such an easy way of doing it. Lot easier than doing it yourself and manually yourself. So you can do it by going to teacupanalytics.com/AdWords. So there you go. Right. Next up, we've got Martin Fraser. See, I've done it again, haven't I? I've forgotten the URL. Why do I always forget the URL with people?
What, from the previous?
Yeah, Ian Frost. I didn't say his URL.
IanFrostWeather.com. You said Ian Frost and weather. And
yeah,
you
but
probably
I didn't
said
say...
.com somewhere else.
So people have to assemble their own URL these days. Okay.
That's fine.
So it's IanFrostWeather.com. Should have been, surely it should have been Ian Frosty Weather. Sorry, I'm not going to let that go. So back to Martin anyway. So Martin, you can find out, I better say the URL quick before I forget it, which is darksnow.net. See, there's a conspiracy going on. What the hell?
I didn't go to his site, Dark Snow.
This is like one of those, you know, when speakers all get together at a conference and they say, oh, let's all sneak something into our talk. That's what they're doing, isn't it? I reckon Martin and Ian know one another, and they said, we both got to get a weather comment in it somewhere. That's what's happened. So Ian is a freelance web developer and a big fan of open source technologies. While he's been programming since the age of 8, bloody hell. Because he doesn't, no offense, Martin, but from your picture, you're not a spring chicken. You know, you're not like, you know, in your... Well, I need to be careful here. You look...
He's younger than you.
He's younger than me. Yeah, well, that doesn't take a lot, does it? So he's been programming since he was 8, and has experienced every corner of the industry, from frontline support, good for you, doing some frontline support. It's a good experience, to embedded development. Oh, and he specializes in Drupal now. Of course he does. Everybody is these days. Drupal's cool, apparently. I don't know. What do I know about any of this? Right. So he's talking about technology-driven design. So he's going to argue that technology drives design rather than design drives technology. And Martin, I'm going to have words with you afterwards.
There are many ways to approach the design of a website. The various paradigms and schools of thought, from atomic and responsive design informing the structure of the code to the more aesthetic considerations of material design, offer a bewildering array of considerations. All of this complexity and the industry in which we find ourselves is underpinned by one thing: the browser. I'd like to argue that on the web, we are living and working in a world of technology-driven design. Throughout the history of what we now call web design, there are numerous examples, some of which I'll discuss here, that show that it's advances in the technology that allow designers to build things on the web. From something simple like curved corners to big ideas like responsive design, designers working on the web have been driven by advances in the technology available to them. Rather than good design pushing the web forward, it's advances in the browser that are pushing good design forward. It's the capabilities of the browser that are paramount to what we build, and therefore how we go about building it. Without the browser, there's no web. There's no UX with its wider implications, no discussions about skeuomorphism, no Google. I'd argue that this makes the browser and the technology packed into it the single most important consideration when designing for the web today. As Louis Sullivan said, form ever follows function. On the web, I think that's doubly important. Clever design can circumvent the limitations of the browser to a certain extent. Inevitably, this requires clever hacks with clever coding to go with it. These hacks usually require non-semantic code or extra markup, are inevitably slower and generally just a bad idea. As the capabilities of the browser improve with time, these limitations are relaxed, and the designer can help create more complex functionality. In all this, the limiting factor is the capabilities of the underlying technology. I created a curved corner effect in CSS before we had border radius. This involves stacking block-level elements above and below the area that you wanted to put the curve round, and manipulating the margins to create pixel steps, effectively creating a curve. That idea was expanded on by changing the colour of these block-level elements to create a glass button effect, as was popular in OS X at the time. So this is a clever hack, but required, as I say, additional markup to make it work. And it was a bit bloated, to say the least. Another example of the progression in browser technology is interactivity in menus. When I started this, we would have a simple list of links that would act as a menu. Then the JavaScript and early CSS implementations in browsers allowed us to add bits of code to the menu buttons themselves, which would detect the mouse movement and swap out a style or a class to change the background image behind the button, thus creating rollover effects. This was relatively complicated and, as such, was quite rare. Then along came CSS hover states, and there's no need for JavaScript, greatly simplifying this problem. Now we've got pure CSS transition states and a host of ICANN that we can apply in pure CSS, and the options for designers have expanded greatly. The scope that designers have now is directly related to the capabilities, the technology available in the browser. The capabilities available in a modern browser are staggering compared to those early days, and designers are keeping up with these new developments to produce more complex and engaging sites. These days, rollovers and rounded corners are trivial, so their implementation is less of a consideration. Take something like web typography. While a designer could have added any typeface they wanted to a web design before the technology was capable of rendering them, the developer would have had to resort to rasterizing the entire page, or embedding images for each letter, or simply rejecting the design and using a system font. In practice, what actually happened here was that the custom fonts were reserved for headers, logos, and other key parts of the site, and they were just images. With the addition FontFace and allowing to import any custom font in the style sheet, designers could include almost any font they wanted. Here, the capabilities of the browser dictate the design for the simple reason that any workaround to support the flights of fancy of a designer were just not worth the hassle. With the addition of further technologies like CSS3 transitions, a whole new avenue of design was opened up. We can now add simple animations to our designs, and the implementation is almost trivial. While we've been able to do animation for a while, it wasn't until the technology caught up that they became a mainstay of the designer's toolbox. Similarly, things like client-side filtering or parallax scrolling, love it or hate it, are only feasible in design because of performance improvements in the browser's render and the JavaScript engines. An example of the capabilities of the browser simply bypassing designers came from the early days of the web and is now called responsive design. The browser has always been responsive by design. When people started taking the web seriously and designers caught on to the implications of the technology, the first people to actually design for the web, rather than just developers exploring, were generally print designers. These designers would try to impose rules on the page so that they could use their well-explored, tried-and-tested techniques to create interesting layouts. This was typically expressed by asking developers, like me, a simple question. What width of page do you want the design to be for? My answer to that was always the same. What resolution is your browser? If an answer was forthcoming to that, I would ask them, what resolution is my browser? What resolution is the browser that guy over there is using? The web has always been fluid by design, the shifting limitations and restrictions which needed to be dealt with appropriately. Floats and fluid widths have helped here a lot, but due to designers wanting the familiar mental model, we had fixed width designs. With the explosion of popularity of mobile browsers, this has really pushed to the fore, and rather than embracing the new tools and the flexibility of the web, we end up with a common pattern of m.dot domains. These were usually cut-down versions of the main desktop website, which would fit onto the bewildering array of mobile devices now accessing the web. Designers would decide what people really wanted to do when they were on the go and create a reduced experience for the reduced browsers. This allowed those teams to serve the tiny screens while maintaining their comfortable fixed-width sites. This allowed those teams to simply ignore the design challenge always inherent on the web. The various tools that have appeared in CSS to allow for what Ethan Marcotte called responsive design gives us the flexibility to reorder and rearrange things based on the detected width of the page. But even with all that available, the now commonplace idea of responsive design was hard won. Here, the technology of the browser has always been available and was expanded to offer greater flexibility, but designers who either misunderstood or rejected these capabilities actually held web design back. And it's not just the visual elements of design that depend on browser capabilities. Thanks largely to the mobile platform, there's been a rise in location services, for example. A designer could have crafted some location-aware customizations to a site, but what would have been required was that the user enter their location before the site knew where they were. Now, the user just needs to give the site permission, and the browser will automatically tell the user where they are. This aspect of design would simply not be possible at all without the technology to support that simple interaction. With the addition of WebRTC, we can now address the video cameras built into a lot of web-capable devices. We can overlay that video stream with any DOM element we like, creating real-time video conferencing in the browser. We can also overlay an HTML canvas over the video feed to add information to whatever the user is pointing their camera phone at, all from within the browser. These are capabilities that not so long ago would have required a browser plugin, or more commonly, a device-specific app. At a lower level, the addition of the XML HTTP request to browsers opened up a whole load of design considerations. With AJAX functionality available, a site no longer needed to update the entire page to make a small change. Before AJAX, we could use iframes or some other off-canvas way to dynamically get content from the server without updating the whole page. The JavaScript to achieve this was usually complicated, but AJAX changed all that. when it appeared in browsers, that seemingly simple API changed the face of web design and opened the door to much richer interaction with the user. Not that long ago, a designer wouldn't have considered building something like Pokemon Go in a browser, but the technology is there to do so now. We have WebGL with full 3D rendering on top of that. We have web-based virtual and augmented reality systems to design for. All of this would have been simply unthinkable on the web just a short decade ago. A designer could have imagined these things, but the feasibility of those designs actually coming to fruition was very small. Throughout my career, I've had people coming up with grand ideas and leaving it to the developer to work out how to make these things a reality. Everything I've said above would have been possible a decade ago, with enough time and a good enough developer, but the solutions would have been subpar, to say the least. To be a good web designer these days, there needs to be an understanding of the underlying technology. A designer needs to know the capabilities of the browser and what will be around the corner. They need to know what is mainstream, like Flexbox, and what can be looked at in future for inspiration, even if it isn't quite ready yet, like CSS Grid. We're straying into the oft-repeated question of whether designers should code, and I'd answer that with a simple yes. I'm not saying the average designer should be able to build out a database-driven CMS, but they do need to understand the underlying medium in which they work. A designer needs to understand the HTML that a complex backend system might generate. A designer needs to know the CSS that allows a grid layer to exist. They need to understand a hex code for colours and perhaps even how a CSS transition works. I stray into saying that they need to understand JavaScript a bit. I don't want designers who are novice coders creating code all over the web. I'm just asking for some understanding. A painter needs to understand how her paint will be absorbed and bleed into a canvas, but doesn't necessarily need to be a weaver. She doesn't need to be able to create the canvas. But any painter of any decent standard understands how their medium works. A sculptor needs to understand the grain of the vein of marble that they take a block from. They need to know how it will crack and flake as they extract a work of art from it. They don't need to extract the stone from the quarry or mine themselves, though some do. They don't need to be a geologist, but they do need to know how their medium functions. A carpenter needs to understand the grain of wood that they're working with. They understand how it will splinter if cut in a certain way, how the grain around the knots will look when a given piece is plain, smooth and varnished. They don't need to be a horticulturalist. They don't need to plant and grow their own forest, but they need to understand how their medium will react. A good web designer should have an understanding of their medium. While the web is a complex beast and I wouldn't expect a designer to need to know the difference between SSL and H2, but I wouldn't expect them not to either. They should know how to use absolute or static positioning in CSS, and perhaps what animation changes would cause a repaint. All of this adds up to what I think is an inescapable conclusion. The technology drives the design. A good web designer should understand the technology that they are working with, understand it will be difficult or impossible for a developer to implement, and design the site under those limitations. Far from stifling a designer's creativity, it is those limitations and restrictions that require a creative solution. From things like curved corners, the addition of typography, new CSS transitions, something like client-side filtering in React, or parallax scrolling, even the ability to have a website scroll sideways rather than up and down. These are all capabilities of the underlying browser that a designer needs to know. It's the improvements in these capabilities in the browser, in the technology, that's pushing the web forward. Looking to the future, it's not just the browser either. With chatbots and direct speech interfaces becoming more prevalent, the remit of what considerations a web designer should have has expanded greatly. A decade ago, a web designer wouldn't have to consider the complications of conversational UX, of spoken tone of voice or shared vocabulary. But now, again, thanks to advances in the underlying technology, that's where we are. If designers don't keep an eye to the future and embrace the technology in the browser, then the web will stagnate. We will never push these things forward. We've seen the design on the web become more and more complex along with improvements to the technology that those designs run on, while through things like the W3C working groups, designers and developers can push the browser and add new features to further design goals. It's the technology in the browsers of today and all the future todays to come that define what's possible on the web, and it's that technology and how we can push it that drives web design, as it always has.
Okay, so that was Martin's controversial talk.
But was it really?
No, not really. But you've got to make the podcast sound more interesting.
Okay, yes, fine. You know,
he is, of course, right in what he was saying. He is right.
Yes.
But here's the question that I've got, right? If people hadn't started hacking rounded corners, right? would the browser manufacturers started and the CSS working group added rounded corners as a piece of, you know, something within the spec. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yep, totally. And I think a little bit of that is probably the case. But generally, it's been about whatever the browsers can do easily has led what designers have done. Because I'm aware of this. I'm not disagreeing with what you just said, by the way, Paul. I think there are certain things like that example which would, you know, that would therefore make it a consideration to make that happen more easily. But I've years and years and years, and it still carries on. I've been having arguments with our team of developers about when we can drop browsers so that we can start using new functionality. You know, it basically allows us to do new stuff.
Yeah.
So this is quite. It just made me think. Yeah, you're absolutely right. A recent one. I'm struggling to remember the name of the technology.
CSS grids.
It's not CSS grids. It's one previous to that. Oh, damn.
You're just embarrassing yourself. Yes. It's going to be something really obvious, isn't it?
It is. Anyway, right, move on. I'll come back to that. I could even drop it in later afterwards, do a bit of editing. I can remember going to a Smashing Talk 2 years ago when there was somebody talking about this particular technology that escapes the name of it, which escapes me now. And I came back and said to Dan, this sounds great, we should be using this. He said, oh, yeah, but we're RE9. Can't do it.
Yeah.
So obviously we've been talking about that for the last couple of years, and we decided that IE9 can kind of go and take a leap, really, not for every site, but for most now. So we can start using this particular piece of technology that's completely escaped me.
Yeah, and it's not like it needs to go away completely. You know, it's not like if you go to this website in IE9, it's going to just break.
Flexbox.
I see.
There you go. Came back.
So, you know, but I actually think I could name quite a few examples. I think the W3C working group is a lot more influenced by us as designers and developers than we think. I mean, I'd need somebody grown up like Rachel Andrew to tell me whether this is true or not. But, you know, the introduction of web typography, which he mentioned, I bet you that was driven by them looking around, looking at what's out there, seeing that everybody's creating inaccessible headings, you know, using images, mm-hmm. and going, oh, we can do better than this. Or layout, CSS grid layout is a direct response to the layout that people have been seeing, you know, that they've seen on the web. So I think it happens quite a lot. That said, absolutely, design constraint is constrained by what technology the browser supports. So Martin is 100% right. Mm. But the other thing that I would say as a designer is I'm not aware. I'm going to stick by the term designer. I am still a designer. Is that more freedom doesn't always equal better design. So take, for example, web typography. Okay.
Yeah.
For years, you were very limited in the fonts that you could use. And so I actually think those constraints, I mean, setting aside the obvious one is now people can use every font in the world. They just fill their website with lots of horrible different fonts and it looks terrible. You know, and they use fonts that aren't really appropriate for the web and blah, 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 blah. But setting that aside, let's pretend that that couldn't happen. Even then, I think the fact that we were limited to a handful of system fonts made us focus more on other elements of typography that we could control. You know, line length, kerning, the color and layout and the other aspects of typography that actually created a nice typographic experience. Okay, so mm-hmm. we were looking at typography more broadly than just, oh, let's get a font and slap it on. And also, another element is that good design, especially the kind of design we do, it's about, you know, the complete user experience, and performance is a big part of the complete user experience, and web fonts can begin to get quite heavy and slow the website down. So I wouldn't say more freedom always leads to better design.
I agree. I also agree entirely with his point about this is what we're talking. This particular subject is a very good reason why designers need to understand code and how browsers work.
Yeah.
But I would say it's not just designers; it's people like me too.
Yes,
I need to understand this stuff.
Yeah,
very much so. Unfortunately, people talk to me about it all the time. So I do keep up. But yeah, this isn't just about code. I.e. a designer designs something that maybe is hard to code. It's about understanding technology, which is a slightly different subject.
I mean, there is an interesting downside. Let me be 100% clear. I absolutely think a designer should be able to code. But one of the associated downsides with a designer knowing how to code is that designer can then start to self-censor themselves in their design because they're worried it couldn't be built, right? Again, it's this little knowledge is a dangerous thing, right? You know, actually, there have been times where I've thought something isn't possible and Dan has made it work because Dan is a bloody good coder, much better than I am. You see what I mean?
Yes, totally.
And so there is a danger that you allow the technology to limit your design. And so your design thinking shouldn't be too heavily influenced by how it's built. Now, it's a balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an interesting area. Cool. Well, there you go. Martin, a brilliant talk, got us both talking and thinking, which is good. Right, Marcus.
I have a joke. This is from Martin Byrne in the Boag World Slack channel.
Yay.
Did you hear about the jurisprudence fetishist?
I saw this one.
He got off on a technicality.
Do you know, it took me an embarrassingly long time to understand that one.
I thought that was very good.
Clever. Yes. A clever joke. Not really suited to this podcast as a result.
No, but you know.
We like to stretch our listeners once in a while. And to be honest, I'm quite glad that I'd seen that in the Slack channel before you told it, because otherwise I'd be sitting here going, what? Why is that funny? So it's a good job I had time to think that one through.
I could have done legal fetishist, not jurisprudence as a bit of a kind of...
That's a long word, isn't it, for our liking? Yeah.
Legal fetishist. Got off on the technical.
All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back again next week. But until then, thank you very much for listening and goodbye. Oh, my God.